Thanks for joining us. It's about 7 past the hour. In a couple of minutes here, or less than a couple of minutes, we're going to talk again to Illinois congressional candidate John Lash, who is running in the 14th district as a Democrat. So we're going to talk with John just in just a moment, for a moment. If you want to check out his website while we're chatting here, john08.com, john08.com. And we have some Chuckle Nuts clips we missed last Friday. Poor old Raisin Brain talking math and stuff, trying to sex up the economy. Ain't working, ain't working. We're in deep doo-doo, that's for sure. And in advance of Super Tuesday, we have a clip of a comedian, Insane John McCain. Crazy John tried to get all jokey today in Boston with some pretty awful results. You know, death is easy, but comedy is impossible for some politicians. So, all in all, just a fun-filled program for you tonight. By the way, I want to remind you again, Saturday, February 23rd, mark it on your calendar. As a matter of fact, mark it so that tomorrow you will go to 1480kphx.com and get tickets to this event that KPHX and Nova M has planned for February 23rd. Scott Ritter and I are going to be in Phoenix for an event that is, I've said it before, it's either going to have people cheering or the cops are going to come, one of the two. It's going to be a rousing program. So if you have not got your tickets yet, there are still some left. 1480kphx.com if you're in the Phoenix area. If you're not in the Phoenix area, what the hell? You know, buy a ticket and get on the bus or a plane or a train and come on over. Love to meet you. Is John here? John is here. John Lash joins us now from Illinois, running again as a Democrat in the 14th Illinois Congressional District. Hey, John, how's it going?
Mike, it's going really good. How are you doing?
We're doing fine. I'm getting a little confused about so-called Super Tuesday tomorrow. I'm not sure how all this delegate stuff works, but we will be here keeping watch and keeping count. How does tomorrow's primary affect your campaign and your candidacy, John?
Well, it affects it in a big way. I'm of the opinion now that being from Illinois, and of course our senator is running for United States president, that in November the turnout would be astronomical if Barack Obama was our candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, the polls all show that Hillary is rather divisive, and that would lead to a larger Republican turnout. So, mm-hmm. In the interest of my race here in the 14th district, it does have it's a factor.
Are you inclined to decide yet which one of these Democratic candidates you'd be supporting?
Well, I'm ready to work with whoever gets to Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
But I've already voted. We have early voting here in the state of Illinois, and I did vote for Senator Obama.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my wife voted for John Edwards because he was still running at the time she voted.
Right, right. Yeah, well, we kind of had that problem here in Atlanta, too. But as far as your campaign is concerned, now you still have to get through a primary, right?
Well, I've got a primary, too, tomorrow. Mike, and you know, the good news is that there are still some rock solid progressives running at the congressional level, not just, you know, my race, but Donna Edwards and Mark Perez running here in the state of Illinois, mm-hmm. against corporate Democrat Dan Lipinski.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's still people out there that stand for the things we believe in, which is essentially change, although even the Republicans are talking about standing for change.
Yeah, well, I could see how that should have been their slogan to begin with after 8 years of Bush, you know, for the Republican Party. But certainly it's just been a nasty situation for the entire country with this guy. I swear to God it has. Well, how have you done any polling? How do you stand with the Democrats that you have to face in the primary?
Well, we do have a primary, and I'm running against an attorney. I think we've got enough of those in Washington. And a very wealthy gentleman who's falls in line with the DLC.
Mm.
So the good news is when we win, we can say that we beat the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And that politics should not be about money; it's about people. There are no polls that I'm aware of. We know that our opponents took a poll and then subsequently induced their campaign with another $400,000 contribution from the candidate.
They must have seen something they didn't like.
Right, and I'm seeing, all I can do is judge what's happening on the ground. We had a great day out at DeKalb, NIU. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of young people who are very enthused about voting for Obama, and they're enthused about voting for our candidacy. So very exciting, and that's been going on at the train stations and anywhere else that we're out there talking to voters in the last days before the election.
How have you done with volunteers on your campaign in the 14th district, John?
Well, that's how we compete with the money. That should be another thing. If anybody wants to help out tomorrow, we're still making phone calls, making sure people turn out to vote. Mm-hmm. They can sign up at john08.com, as you already pointed people to the website, and make calls from anywhere.
All right, for people who are listening, other parts of the country that can't get there, of course, you still need campaign contributions.
You know what we're going to on February 6th?
And,
well, February 5th, because we have, here's the thing, we have two primaries on February 5th.
Mm-hmm.
One, of course, is the special election primary.
Right.
That'll be settled to fill the rest of Hastert's term.
Mm-hmm.
So on February 6th, we'll have 31 days to run again for the March 8th special election.
Mm-hmm.
But the good news is we can have a solid progressive to Washington by March of this year.
So you might be able to get there early, is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. Dennis Hastert retired, so.
Right.
If I win both the primaries tomorrow and the special election,
mm-hmm.
I'll be in Washington, D.C. as soon as March of this year. Yep. And it'll be a vote to defund the Iraq War, a vote for fair trade agreements, and a vote for single-payer health care.
It would also be another incumbent Democrat in the House, progressive incumbent Democrat in the
right.
House, that which is doubly important. What can people do to help you out right now?
Number one thing is stop by and offer to pick up 20, 25 phone calls. If people live in the district, they can certainly go out and vote twice tomorrow. We're supposed to get some snowy weather.
Mm-hmm.
I think low turnout or high turnout, I feel good about how we're going to be in the polls, but certainly, making those calls is going to make all the difference in making sure that somebody who's driving around in those precincts and can give them a ride is, if we can connect those dots, then mm-hmm. we're going to win. But, anybody wants to make a campaign contribution, I can't spend any more money on advertising between, tonight and tomorrow morning.
Right.
But certainly, pay attention to what's going on, and, we're going to need all the help we can get. Both of the Republicans, whoever comes out on the Republican side, both of those are millionaires also.
Mm-hmm. Does it appear that the 14th Illinois is going to be Democrat, given what the Republicans have done?
There's three factors. One, I would say, is of course George Bush has turned off a lot of Republicans. We have people who are not just voting for John Lash, but volunteering for John Lash because even though they were former Republicans, they understand that this country is off course and they want mm-hmm. to change that. And, through discussion, they've come to recognize that we have a lot more in common, which is the second point. The newspaper endorsements that came through, and even after we won several debates, they would say, well, John Lash won the debate, but he needs to move to the middle. And I think this is the wrong question to be asking, because I think, quite frankly, that at this point in the game, we are in the middle. When 65% of Americans say they want single-payer national health care, that's a majority.
That's
the
right.
middle.
That's
and,
right.
When 58% say they want fair trade agreements and use tariffs to level the playing field on an international scale,
mm-hmm.
that's the middle. And the same is true with Iraq. I mean, I know it's well over 70% of Americans that want to bring the troops home sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that we are in the middle, and that's the second factor. The third factor, of course, is that neither of the Republican candidates are really palatable to the other side of the aisle. It's almost like watching the presidential election.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How they're shuffling and deciding if they can stomach John McCain or Mitt Romney.
Right, right.
Or God help us if Mike Huckabee makes the...
No. Don't know that. I don't think that's going to happen. I think Wednesday Huckabee will make his concession speech and throw his support to probably his Lord and Savior. And the second choice would be, I'm sure, would be McCain. John, we're going to be watching your district closely tomorrow night. So good luck. I know you've done the groundwork. I hope everything works out. And once you get past that first primary, we'll talk again, okay?
Okay, thanks for having us back on. I apologize that we missed you while we were having our health care rally the other night.
No, you have more important things to do, John, than be on this program the other night. So glad you could make it tonight. Take care. We'll talk again, all right?
Take care, Mike. Bye-bye.
All right, John. Bye-bye. John08.com. Check it out, okay? Welcome back, 22 past the hour. Yeah, check out John Lash. You all were great about staying on top of the Nancy Skinner for Congress thing. Check out John Lash, john08.com. Anyone who says that there are no progressive Democrats running for office, of course, is mistaken. So check out his site. If there's something you want to do to help his candidacy, do it. There's a book coming out tomorrow, written by New York Times reporter Philip Sheenan. Is it Sheenan? I think it's Sheenan. The title is The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. And it's a heavy-duty criticism. I have not read it yet, but I have read the buzz that's out there about this book in political circles and in the chattering classes. The book apparently reveals the failure at the highest levels of the U.S. government where it concerns not just the investigation, but also the events leading up to 9/11. Now, I'll tell you right now, I don't think that it comes to any conclusion that has been arrived at by people on the 9/11 conspiracy side of the argument, of which I probably would find myself drifting more towards that than the non-conspiratorial side. And again, it's for the reason, the very basic reason that I stated many, many times. If this administration would lie about everything as it has, why would it not lie about the events of 9/11? So, I try to keep it simple, stupid. You know, I try to kiss it off, keep it simple, stupid. And that's my conclusion. But anyway, Philip Sheenan singles out, among others, Condoleezza Rice as totally inept. Boy, there's a surprise, right? The shoe lady, inept, really? More interested in being Bush's buddy than making sure the nation is secure as the National Security Advisor or as later Secretary of State. Newsweek editor Evan Thomas wrote a preview of the book, and this is at Think Progress. Thomas wrote, "The official ineptitude uncovered by the commission is shocking. Dub kinda lies a lot by the Jersey girls. Ms. Rice comes across as almost clueless about the terrorist threat." And this is from the book. Quote, "Whatever her job title, Rice seemed uninterested in actually advising the president," end quote. Instead, quote, "she wanted to be his closest confidant, specifically on foreign policy, and to simply translate his words into action," end quote. I don't think that comes as a shock to any of us being certainly anyone connected with this program and the people who tune into this program. Condoleezza Rice is a phony. We all know that. She is so far in so far above her pay grade as to render the office of Secretary of State meaningless since she took over that position. The office of National Security Advisor, meaningless for the entire 4 years that she was there. It's just shocking how the Bush crime family filled key positions, whether they were in regulatory agencies, cabinet positions, positions of advising the president, counsel to the president, with men and women who are totally corrupt by their ignorance, their inability to do the job, and primarily their disinterest. They just didn't care. It was all for show, just like Bush's presidency. Had it not been so malignant, would have been all for show. Bush could have been an Eisenhower, for example, and just been there for show. But his entire presidency was so incredibly malignant, and everyone connected with that presidency, incredibly malignant, either in an active or a passive sense. And of course, it's going to be up to the historians to prove to later readers of the history of the Bush crime family to understand just how malignant this gang was. An example of Rice's incompetence is the fact that on July 10th, 2001, 2 months before the 9/11 terrorist attacks, then CIA Director George Tenet met with Rice and warned her about a threat from Al-Qaeda that, quote, literally made his hair stand on end, end quote. This is from the book. Rice was polite, but gave him the brush off. The 9/11 Commission, however, heard nothing about this meeting. Only after, or heard about the meeting, only after it completed its report. Philip Sheehan reveals that the Commission Executive Director, Philip Zelikow, a close friend of Rice, stopped staff members from submitting a report depicting Rice's performance prior to 9/11 as amounting to incompetence. More when we come back.
How like a blonde that stacked, and Rumsfeld wants his fanny smack.
National Security Advisor to help unstick things that may get stuck. Best way to put it is an unsticker.
She's an unsticker. Well, according to a new book coming out tomorrow by Philip Sheehan, New York Times reporter, she was a lot less than an unsticker. Condoleezza Rice's function during her tenure as National Security Advisor was to be Bush's closest confidant and buddy, and you know, stuff like that. The book explains how the 9/11 Commission, when they were taking testimony, never heard about the meeting between Tenet and Rice 2 months before 9/11. Now that staggers the imagination for anyone who still believes that the 9/11 Commission was anything other than a smokescreen put up to make Americans say, oh, okay, is that what happened? Okay, oh, God, well, let's go kill some more Iraqis. If you believe anything other than that was the function 9/11 Commission report, you're a real dumbass, okay? I don't know how else to put it. I can't think of better terms. You're just a dumbass. The 9/11 Commission report was nothing more nor less than a deliberate smokescreen. However, nobody really, the people charged with putting up the smokescreen, the two co-chairs, weren't even aware of how thick the smoke was going to be. It's just astonishing. So now it turns out that Condoleezza Rice had ample opportunity in her role as National Security Advisor to listen to the people who were feeding intelligence and saying, look, we have every indication here that all hell is going to break loose. There's going to be a spectacular attempt inside the country to embarrass this administration, to strike back at the United States for several issues that are just eating a hole into the hearts of these crazed Islamic fundamentalists. But Rice and the members of the Bush cabinet who were charged with protecting, as he says, the American people, would have none of it. They didn't give a damn. It was all just, oh, well, let me put some shoes on. and go pose in front of the cameras. I am, after all, the National Security Advisor. Another particularly bumbling figure in Philip Sheehan's new book is Ashcroft. On July 17th, 2001, now these dates are important because they predate 9/11. On July 17th, 2001, the then Attorney General received the same CIA briefing as the shoe lady did about an imminent strike on an American target, according to Philip Sheehan. Now, while Condoleezza Rice was interested in being Bush's buddy and playing grab ass with George, I guess when Pickles was out of town or whatever, Ashcroft, on the other hand, was focused during this time on protecting gun owners. According to Sheehan's book, quote, Attorney General John Ashcroft appears more interested in protecting gun owners from government intrusion than in stopping terrorism, and dismissively tells acting FBI Director Thomas Picard that he doesn't want to hear any more about threats of terrorist attacks. Well, that took care of that, didn't it, huh? This filthy pig Ashcroft, when he was given intelligence information that things were burbling around out there prior to the attack, well, he just didn't want to hear about it. He had the gun lobby that he had to satisfy. Oh, that's right. And he also had to satisfy the church ladies by stopping porn websites. You remember that? Now, according to Sheehan, also, then White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, before he was attorney general, he was intent on placing blame for the attack on the Clinton administration. When Ashcroft, quote, unveiled a memo that seemed to cast the anti-terror record of the Clinton Justice Department in an unflattering light, Gonzalez and his aides high-fived each other, end quote. Now, this is the kind of clown act that had been running the country. Rice, Bush, Ashcroft, Gonzalez, and the whole inner circle cadre around Cheney. These are the half-witted bastards who are running this country. All they were interested in doing is striking poses that appeared, that were designed to give the appearance that they were governing, when in fact, what they were doing was playing grab-ass with each other and making sure that real special interests were being taken care of. The gun lobby, corporate America, the energy industry. How do you think ExxonMobil managed to show last year $40 billion profit, the largest profit in the history of global capitalism for one company? How do you suppose they were able to do that? Because oil futures went to $100 a barrel? Nah, come on, get real. You know how they did it. That's what the entire thrust of this filthy, corrupt Bush crime family has been, to further the profits of corporate America, to further hamstring and defund and end regulatory agencies, to make sure that the wealthiest 1% or one half of 1% in this country controlled 20, 30, 40% of the wealth. That's an exaggeration, but you know what I'm saying. That has been their sole goal. I know it sounds like three goals, but that has been their sole function and purpose, is to take care of that particular constituency. And they've done a good job, haven't they? Meanwhile, the other 98% of us have been screwed to the ground. And now it turns out that even the 9/11 Commission, although it was put together only at the insistence of these widows, the so-called Jersey girls, and only after Bush and Cheney said, no investigation. You 9/11 people who insist that the official story is the true story, what is your answer to this question? Why did Bush and Cheney not want an investigation of the events of 9/11? Why did Bush and Cheney only show up to provide testimony together and not under oath? I mean, this was the single most devastating attack on U.S. soil ever by a foreign operation against the U.S. government. And yet, Bush and Cheney did everything in their power to prevent an examination of the facts as they were dribbling out. and then refuse to testify under oath. You've got to ask yourself, you people who just absolutely sit back on your dumb asses and say, well, the official 9/11 story is what really happened. Jesus God, how can you be this thick? I mean, I know there's a big investment, emotional investment, in sticking with the real story, because if you are sticking with the official story, if you stick with the official Bush crime family story of the events prior, on, and subsequent to 9/11, you're safe. Mental, you know, an emotional breakdown won't happen to you. If you start looking at not just the facts, but questionable aspects of the events of that day, then you come away with a feeling of, wait a second, I'm not sure about that anymore. I'm not sure, and that's very dangerous. Because if the truth ever does come out, and I've said this for years now, if the truth ever comes out about this, I think the American public would either immediately go into the fetal position and start sucking its thumb, or they would take up weaponry and immediately overthrow the government, because it would be clear that it was no longer a government of, by, or for the people. I mean, come on. So it is very easy and expected for most people to be unable to question the official story. So here comes the New York Times reporter, Philip Sheehan, saying, look, this is what Rice said and did. This is what Ashcroft said and did. And this is what Philip Zelikow said and did. And we'll get to that a little bit later in the program. He was the September 11 Commission's executive director. And it's coming out now in this book that Philip Zelikow, who a lot of people identify as an American Zionist, had closer ties with the Bush White House than publicly disclosed, and that he tried to influence the final report in ways that even the smokescreen 9/11 staff perceived as limiting the Bush administration's responsibility. Zelikow was a friend of then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. He spoke with her several times during the 20-month so-called investigation. He also had frequent phone calls with the White House, including at least four from Karl Rove during the time when the commission was taking critical testimony. Now, son of a bitch, I mean, what do some of you people need? You need a 2x4 upside the head? What do you need to get your attention? That whatever you have heard about what happened prior to, on, and subsequent to 9/11 is nothing but a huge tapestry of lies. What will it take for you to understand that? I don't know what the truth is. I'm not advocating any particular point of view at this point. But how can you possibly believe that what we have been told about 9/11 is even remotely close to the truth? More in a minute. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
I'm sure that Europe is a lovely place to visit. My wife would love to go there every single year. But they're just puppies.
Yep, 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 yep.
They need to shut their yaps. The big dogs over here. I will rule the world forever. I'm straight and white and male American and free.
Condoleezza.
Very comfortable in the job because I've got great advice and advisors to whom I get good advice from great advisors to whom I listen.
Oh, God. Jack writes in regarding the commission report and this book. Jack writes, Mike, so tomorrow New York Times reporter Philip Sheehan's book will be released, which will prove beyond a shadow of a doubt the ineptitude and hubris which continues to plague this rapacious Bush administration. So then what? What'll happen? Nothing. How many more books must they publish before this administration is held accountable? How many? This is nothing more than smoke and mirrors. There'll be no accountability. Well, that's true. There will not be. The really to me, sad commentary on the state of the confidence of American politicians on the Democratic side, all of them, the lack of confidence, is the fact that this would be just like when Clinton took over in after the 92 election. He had a chance to rip the facade off this Republican filth machine, these murderous sons of bitches that had operated during both Reagan and Bush 1. And Clinton refused to do it. There was no investigation of Iran-Contra. There was nothing. Everything was just deep-sixed and forgotten about. Well, not forgotten about, but it was prevented from going forward to the point now we are 16 years later, and who cares? 15 years later, and who cares? Who cares what happened during the 80s in Central America? Who cares that the United States was responsible for upwards of 300,000 innocent people being slaughtered like so many damn animals in Central America? Who cares, you see? The Central Americans care. The rest of the world cares, the people who understand. But the American public, no. Bill Clinton made sure that that truth would never come out. So why are we to believe that the truth of 9/11 will come out? That will be even more difficult for the American mind to wrap itself around, if not impossible, because it will indicate, on whatever level you choose to put it, acts of either, at the very least, treasonous incompetence on the part of this Bush crime family, at the very worst, complicit action by either inaction or direct action in allowing or promoting or leaving the gate open for these attacks to occur in this country. And I don't believe that the American public can handle that. I really don't. Just like Colonel What's-His-Name in A Few Good Men said, you can't handle the truth. And I honestly believe that most of us cannot. Just simply cannot handle the truth. I get just dozens of emails constantly from people who want to say, Mike, you know, don't go over the dark side. Don't get in this conspiracy crap about 9/11. Don't, you know, what happened. It was bad enough. Don't make it worse. And all I can say to people who send me those emails is, if that is your if that's the way you are able to cope, if that's your coping mechanism, have at it. I mean, but the thing about coping mechanisms, they should be reserved for your own personal sanity. Don't promote them. Don't evangelize them, because they won't work for other people. Surely you understand that. The truth about 9/11 is something I don't think is we will know for a very, very long time. And when that truth does come out, if it ever comes out, I think it's just going to be almost impossible to handle. But back to the book written by Philip, Sheenan, this book that's coming out tomorrow. He's talking now about the September 11 Commission's executive director, Philip Zelikow, who, among other things, tried to push through wording in a draft report from the commission that suggested a tie between Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and Iraq. Now, this is what the White House told him to do. And now, by White House, that means Karl Rove and or Dick Cheney. The commission, the 9/11 commission, resisted that, according to the book, Philip Sheenan's book. Sheenan says Zelikow sought to intimidate staff to avoid damaging findings about President Bush, who at the time was running for re-election, and for Condoleezza Rice. Apparently, Rice and Zelikow had written a book together in 1995, and he would later work for her after the commission finished its job, and she became Secretary of State in 2005. Now, all this information is out there, and of course the White House has no comment. According to the book, when Democratic Commissioner Bob Kerry learned the extent of Zelikow's ties to the Bush crime family, he, Kerry, confronted Republican Chairman Tom Keene and demanded to know why someone with such apparent conflicts of interest had been hired. And Kerry is quoted in the book as saying, look, Tom, either he goes or I go. Sounds like John Kerry saying, we won't leave Ohio until all the votes are counted, because Keene eventually persuaded Bob Kerry to stay right where he was and to sit down and shut up. Former Representative Lee Hamilton, who was the panel's Democratic vice chairman, praised Zelikow as a, quote, person of integrity, end quote, who is up front in disclosing his background and his White House contacts. And according to Hamilton, it made sense for commission staff. Now, of course, Zelikow was not staff. He was the executive director. But Hamilton, in his position of being part of the cover-up, part of the lies, part of the deception, he said it was it made sense for commission staff to contact the White House regularly to, quote, get information, end quote. Son of a bitch, to get information. Bush and Cheney could have provided all the information this commission possibly could have wanted simply by showing up individually, being sworn in, and providing testimony. Neither of them did it. The commission did not ask for it or insist upon it, and they allowed themselves to be rolled once again, the way the Democratic Party leadership is being rolled, the way the United States public is being rolled. The book says phone logs maintained by the commission's executive assistant showed at least two calls from Rove, to Zelikow's office number in June 2003 and two more in September. During that time, the commission was in the midst of its fact-finding. More on this when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Welcome back. Second hour of the Malloy program here. It's about 7 past the hour. This is the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. We are talking here a bit about a new book that is coming out, I think it's to be released tomorrow, by Philip Sheenon, who is a New York Times reporter. The title of the book is The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. And it, in several words, it reveals the failure at the highest levels of the U.S. government where it concerns the events leading up to, on, and subsequent to, if you want to read into it, the events of 9/11. I think what the author focuses on is the 9/11 Commission and how inept I think it was. I think most of us understand that the 9/11 Commission, like other commissions having been put together to investigate crimes, very serious crimes in this country that required a commission, it was to reassure the American public that what its lying eyes was seeing was really not the case. Kind of like the videotape of the beating of, what was his name? Rodney King. We all watched that beating. As it went on for 15 or 20 minutes, we know what we saw. But then, of course, the first jury in Simi Valley, an all-white jury, I believe it was all-white, was convinced by, if they needed convincing, by the defense that what we saw was not really what happened at all. So the 9/11 Commission was nothing more than a smokescreen. But what is occurring now that a book revealing the inner workings of the 9/11 Commission, it shows how miserable even the smokescreen is. It's and yet impeachment is off the table. Now Zelikow, this Philip Zelikow, who worked for Bush 1, was a friend of Condoleezza Rice's. He winds up as the commission's executive director. The if you want to draw a parallel between the Bush crime family and the Soviet Union, this was the political director appointed by the Bush crime family to sit in and make sure that the so-called investigation only went in one direction and one direction only, that any attempt to truly get to facts would be immediately squashed. That was not going to happen. That was Zelikow's function as the commission's executive director. It says in the book that phone logs maintained by the commission's executive assistant, that would be Zelikow's gopher, showed at least two calls from Rove to Zelikow's office number in June 2003 and two more in September. And it was during that time that the commission was in the midst of its fact-finding. Zelikow ordered the assistant to stop keeping phone records of his contacts with the White House, according to the book. Now you got to ask yourself, don't you? Why would he do that? Remember, this is a truth commission. This is the 9/11 commission. And yet the commission's executive director, no offense to sex workers, a cheap ass waste of human DNA, Philip Zelikow, whore, is put in there to make sure no real investigation occurs. And that's assuming that a real investigation was ordered to begin with, which it wasn't. Hamilton and Keene were no more interested in getting at the truth than Zelikow. But Hamilton and Keene knew they had to go through the pro forma horse hockey to pretend that they were getting at the truth. And Zelikow and Rove and Cheney and Bush didn't even want that. The phone logs that were kept do not record Zelikow's calls out, nor do they show calls on his cell phone, which, according to the book, he relied on for most outgoing calls. Records from the Government Accountability Office, which maintains some of the commission's phone records, showed frequent calls from Zelikow to telephone numbers in area code 202 with the phone prefix 456. That is the prefix exclusive to the White House. Frequent calls. Zelikow, in his written statement, said Karl Rove had called with questions about the Bush Library and other business related to Zelikow's work at the University of Virginia. Oh, no. None of the phone calls were about the 9/11 Commission. No. The fact that the phone calls occurred primarily during the time when the commission was taking testimony, and during the time when the commission was in the midst of its fact-finding. No. Pure coincidence. Building 7 and the collapse of the Twin Towers, pure coincidence that it fell into its footprint. No, that happens. That happens, you see, when steel scaffolding reaches a certain... No, it just happens. The fact that there's not one single frame that shows a jetliner. We know a jetliner crashed into the Pentagon. Of course it did. Absolutely it did. The fact that a 43 cameras covering every goddamn inch of the Pentagon refuses to cough up one frame that shows an airplane. There you go, Malloy. Jumping to your conspiracy conclusions. The fact that the site where Flight 93 crashed in Pennsylvania yielded up not one piece of human remains. There you go, Malloy. The official story will be accepted. Period. Now, Zelikow, in a statement to the author of this book, said, "Karl Rove and I really did not know each other. I don't recall," he said, "ever having an extended conversation with him, and certainly not about politics or the commission." Aha. Well, there you go. That ends that. The book says that in early 2004, Zelikow allegedly sought to add to an initial staff report wording that linked al-Qaeda to Iraq. The wording would have said the terrorist network repeatedly tried to communicate with the government of Saddam Hussein, a claim of cooperation that the Bush crime family has cited over and over again to justify the invasion and occupation of that poor, godforsaken little country. Now, after a protest from the 9/11 Commission staff, because even though the 9/11 Commission was put together to provide the smokescreen, even they could only go so far with the BS. And there was a protest about this one. They said, no, Philip, you're going way, way too far with this one. So Zelikow backed down on that. The final report said there was, quote, no collaborative relationship, end quote, between Saddam and al-Qaeda. And Zelikow has said that he simply wanted the 9/11 Commission to keep an open mind on the issue. You son of a bitch. It's people like this. See, now that will be the statement that will hang out there for all of eternity, that Philip Zelikow only wanted the Commission to keep an open mind, and that's why he tried to inject into the final report all these lies. You think you know the truth about 9/11, do you, Booby? Huh? You think you have it all down? And you're absolutely and utterly convinced that people who say otherwise are either conspiracy theorists, have way too much time on their hand, ill-informed, poorly educated, don't understand physics, have no idea of the global chess game going on, fail to realize that even an entity like the Bush crime family would never do such a thing. Well, like I say, like John Lennon said, whatever gets you through the night, if that's your comfort zone, then by God, stay in it. Because as soon as you step out, all your theories, everything that has been firmly planted in your head by media, academia, and government will come crashing down. And you know what? You're going to be naked there for a moment, emotionally speaking, and that's risky. Past the hour. Sheila writes in regarding why we believe what we believe. Orwell had an interesting choice of words. He said, quote, people will believe what the media tells them they believe, end quote. Orwell did not say what the media tells them to believe. People will believe what the media tells them they believe. And Sheila points out, big difference. John in San Antonio writes, Mike, 9/11 is what made me switch sides. When I began digging into that pack of lies, I found others, and they are limitless, obvious, the smoking gun at every turn. Where's the opposition? Where can I cast my vote? Where is our watchdog? Why the hell can't Lou Dobbs get into this like he does the Mexicans picking grapefruit? Why does Tucker Carlson giggle at the 9/11 truth seekers from the safety of an email reply? Why doesn't Chris Matthews have one of the 9/11 expert Air Force generals or pilots or engineers or physicists on his show to debate it scientifically? If the shoe was on the other foot, would Tom DeLay say, impeachment is off the table? Where the hell is the opposition? John in San Antonio. And also, the question, I think the proof of the utter incompetence and uselessness of Condoleezza Rice, she was national security advisor during the greatest failure in national security this country has ever experienced. And what happens? That's right. She gets promoted to Secretary of State. Had it been you, truth seeker, wouldn't you have resigned? But Condoleezza Rice, in her complicity in all this, or her idiocy, or her ignorance, or the fact that she just wanted to be, George's mutual back scratcher. I want to hang out with George. I want to be his confidant. When the histories are written, I want to be the dark lady that sat by George's side and held his hand through all this because, you know, he is a war president. Oh, God. A very quick call here. Let's go to Ron, who is calling from Davis, California, listening on KSAC. Ron, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Yeah, well, I'm just angry as hell, as usual. But, yeah, I really believe you're right around the American public not being able to stomach the actual truth. The analogy I would use would be if, a truth seeker showed up at Joe Sixpack's house and everybody was having hamburgers, and the truth seeker said, I'm sorry, but you can't eat any more hamburgers until you visit a slaughterhouse and take your whole family. Because that's actually what happens. That's where the hamburgers originate.
Right.
And I just don't, think they could handle it.
I know I damn sure couldn't.
Yeah. And so, but in other words, you can't eat any more beef burgers because this is reality. And usually when I say that to people, they go, Ron, man, why do you have to be such a downer?
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So my thing with 9/11 is I've seen tons of videos and all that, but I haven't really done a lot of research. The thing that blows my mind is, and I've talked to building engineers and so forth on this, I just have one simple question. Two simple questions. A, have you ever seen Building 7 collapse, which was 9 hours after the airplanes hit?
Right.
And B, how do you think that building collapsed like that?
Yeah, I know.
And that's about it. And then I just walk away because to me, and I'm sure to you, it's no surprise that it was an inside job. I certainly can handle that level of truth. But to most Americans, it's like going to a slaughterhouse to eat a hamburger.
Yeah, I hear you. That's a good point. Good point.
All right, buddy, hang in.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate it. Take care. You know, I've got some essential questions about it, too. I really do. And without turning the program into a discussion of 9/11, because you and I are not going to solve anything. It's just masturbatory fantasies to think that discussing this on a radio program is going to have any effect whatsoever on the truth. So let's not even go there. But the essential element for me where it concerns that it did not happen the way we were told it happened or under the circumstances we were told it happened is the fact that until I suck in my last breath, I will no more believe that 19 people came to this country armed with box cutters and defeated the entire defense and security establishment of the United States, a security and defense establishment that had been in effect for over a century. That I cannot accept. Now, I realize that sometimes the simplest explanation is the correct one. And I understand that there have been moments in history when a very simple act has resulted in utter catastrophe. The guy on the bridge of the Titanic who didn't pay any attention to the nearest ice flow is probably one example. But I will never, ever, ever accept the idea that 19 bombers came to this country and armed with box cutters and passports and plane tickets defeated the intelligence, defense, and military organizations of the United States. Never.
liberal helping of truth? It's more of Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour. All right, I've got one soundbite here I want to play for you from Insane John McCain at his Boston campaign stop today. You know, all of a sudden he's trying for humor. If there's anything John McCain should not go for, it's humor. Anything but humor. Tragedy. What else could he do? Suspense. Horror, but not comedy. You know, I listened to this, or I heard this. I kept waiting for him to make some sort of quip about his torture as a prisoner of war. Now, after his second show, Insane McCain scooted off to Hamilton, New Jersey to tell the crowds he wouldn't predict a win on Super Tuesday tomorrow because he's superstitious. Great. That's just what we need. A president who is superstitious. So what does that mean? If he forgets to turn the light switch off and on three times before he leaves the bathroom, for example, then what? Got to bomb Iran? If he walks under a ladder, that means a couple of nukes into Gaza City. What is with this freak? Let's just listen to a little bit of Too Insane for Primetime McCain.
I'm compelled to tell the story of the two inmates in the state prison in the chow line.
Yeah.
And one of them turned to the other one and said,
huh?
The food was a lot better in here when you were governor. That's not a joke you can tell in some states in America. And from the great state of South Carolina, Senator Lindsey Graham. After this meeting, if you would like to talk with Senator Graham, we will provide translators for any of you that need to find them hard to understand. I find them hard to... Anyway, Senator Lindsey Graham is not only a United States Senator, he serves as a colonel in the United States Air Force Reserve lawyer. When Congress votes themselves a pay raise and goes on vacation for a month, Lindsey Graham puts on his uniform as the United States Air Force lawyer, goes to Iraq in the summertime in 120-degree heat and tries to help, does everything he can to help the Iraqi people have the rule of law.
A trial lawyer.
You know the difference between a lawyer and a catfish. One is a scum-sucking bottom dweller. The other is a fish. And so there goes the lawyer vote again. But thank you all I thank all of you for being here.
Hey, you guys are the best. And the 11 show is different from the 9 show. Don't forget, do come by and see us. Tell your friends, all right? We'll be here in the Catskills for at least another 6 weeks. My name's John McCain. Hey, have a nice evening. Goodbye. Now you tell me, what if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama mocked Southern accents and made lawyer jokes and prison jokes, especially since the governor of Alabama is in prison because of Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and these vicious sons of bitches who now think McCain is too liberal? What would happen if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama did what McCain just did? I'll tell you what, you could send McCain's little stand-up to Gitmo. Forget waterboarding. Listen to this enough times and you'll start confessing anything. My God. Hey, what's the difference between a lawyer and a catfish? one of them has whiskers. I think it would be appropriate right now to take AJ's call, since AJ lives in the Catskills. AJ, the Music Factory. Hey, partner.
Hey, handsome. How you doing tonight?
I'm getting by. Could McCain make it in one of those?
No, I wanted to start out by saying he does not play in the Catskills. I want to make that clear.
All right.
Don't give him to us, for God's sake. You know, I've been thinking a lot about what you say when you say, you always get me when you say, no offense to sex workers, and I think there's a bit of truth to that.
Yeah.
I think you want to, you know, you don't want to insult people by calling them these politicians. And so I started thinking about all the names I call them. And I say, you know, that applies to just about everything. If you say they're a dog, it's no offense to dogs. And
right.
And the other week I heard a word, and I think it describes these guys. And the word is trocar, T-R-O-C-A-R.
Trocar.
Do you know what a trocar is?
I do not.
See, all the funeral directors in the country perked up their ears just now.
Oh, yeah?
A trocar is the bar.
Yeah.
That embalmers insert into a body in order to liquefy the organs so that they can remove them.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad you shared that with me.
Now, doesn't that work perfectly?
A trocar.
Are these people not trocarian?
Yes, they are.
Oh, don't you think? Okay. So the reason I called...
Trocar, huh?
I meant to call you last week after the State of the Union,
yeah,
which was so stunningly lacking. I mean, you know, you didn't expect anything, but Liza and I sat here playing a game while Bush talked.
Uh-huh.
And as the speech came to an end, we looked at each other and said, "That's it." I mean, you know, there were no punchlines. There were no like typical presidential
right
punchlines.
Right.
And it was just amazingly flat. But what I took notice of was the next day, and I didn't hear anybody talk about this. He talked about a stimulus package in the address,
mm-hmm,
and then the following day, because he wanted to bully the Senate into passing it, he said his usual, you know, I urge the Senate to pass this, and he said, so that we can get the money into the hands of our consumers. And that blew me away, that he would refer to the people as our consumers.
Our consumers.
To objectify them in that way. And when a trocar like Bush has a accidental moment of truth like that,
it's
you have
scary
to listen.
Yeah, it's scary, too.
Yeah, but you have to listen, because he accidentally let out what he really thinks. And how he really feels.
Right.
And what really motivates him.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, it's all shadow. You can't catch him. He's so slippery, and so are his people. But I just was stunned by that he would say, into the hands of our consumers.
Okay? Our consumers.
Yeah, yeah. And I would just tack on what you've been talking about with Sheenan's book, is that I'm getting really tired of these delayed revelations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people coming out 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, writing books, putting, you know, investigations into place about things that we knew when they were unfolding.
Right, I mean, but you and I are just, I mean, you live in the Catskills and make music. I live outside Atlanta and do talk radio. We don't count. It doesn't make any difference.
No, but I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, this is not like a tell-all book about J. Edgar Hoover when they reveal that he wore dresses and you know,
not that there's anything wrong with it.
No, absolutely not. But that. That he would, you know, that people would say, "Oh God, I never saw that coming." We did see. We watched the hearings, mm-hmm, every day. We stood up in our chairs and said, "Ask questions."
Right, right, right.
Say something. And
please,
they didn't do it.
I know.
Please.
I know. I know. It's like having some sort of a rip in the time-space continuum where we are on this side in this parallel universe, and that commission was on that side in that one of millions of parallel universes, and we could scream through the rip, but they couldn't hear us. We could see through the rip and could scream if we wanted to, but nobody would hear. And the rip was presented to us as though it were a telescreen of C-SPAN, when in fact... In fact, it was a warp or a tear in the time-space continuum, and there you go. There's the proof of parallel universes right there.
Yeah, and now Sheenan, bless his heart, he's going to make a lot of money on a book about something that we could have told him years ago because we were all watching the damn television.
Yeah,
and we saw it happen.
But you are the music factory. I am the talk radio guy, so it doesn't make it makes no difference what we think at all, AJ. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Better dead than red.
I hear you. Thanks, pal. Take care.
Peace.
We'll be right back. This is Nova M Radio.
With Mike Malloy.
You know that's a game that I hate to lose. And I'm feeling the strain. Oh, yeah. Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock.
It's about 10 before the hour. Very quickly here. We have some sound coming up for you at the beginning of the next hour. But, Evan Thomas has reviewed, apparently, the 9/11 book by Philip Sheenan, and Clint sent this to him. It's very quick. It's titled The Tragicomic Tale of the 9/11 Report, and Evan Thomas writes, journalists like to talk about the backstory, the story behind the story. The backstory can be nothing more than vaguely sourced gossip trade among pundits and politicals before they go on talk shows. But sometimes the backstory is the real, whole truth, a tale of conniving or official blundering that the headlines can only hint at. Journalists often conceal the whole truth because they need to protect their sources. Philip Sheenan, a reporter in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, set out to get behind the scenes of the 9/11 Commission. The inside story of a government commission doesn't sound very promising. Most commission reports wind up unread on dusty shelves. When the 9/11 Commission announced its findings in the summer of 2004, the response was by and large respectful. Reprinted as a book titled The 9/11 Commission Report, it was an instant bestseller, unusual for a document written by a committee. But its popularity was owed mostly to a spare, riveting narrative of the shocking events of September 11, 2001, not to its policy recommendations or revelations about official malfeasance. So why go over it all again? Mr. Sheenan is a skillful writer and storyteller as well as a dogged reporter. In his book, he makes bureaucratic warfare exciting, largely because he has a keen grasp of human frailty and folly. He opens with a desperate, almost pathetic scene of Samuel Berger, Bill Clinton's national security advisor, sneaking documents out of the National Archives. Mr. Berger had actually been more attentive to the threat of al-Qaeda than most government officials, including his successors in the Bush administration, but he apparently feared that he and his boss would become scapegoats. Mr. Sheenan writes of Mr. Berger, quote, beneath his gruff amiability, there was deep insecurity that even he admitted bordered on paranoia, end quote. In a memorable scene, Mr. Sheenan depicts the widows of 9/11 victims, a group that called itself the Jersey Girls, meeting Kissinger, President Bush's choice to be chairman of the 9/11 Commission, in the posh offices of Mr. Kissinger's international consulting firm in New York. When one of the Jersey Girls asks Mr. Kissinger if he has any clients named Bin Laden, Mr. Kissinger spills his coffee and nearly falls off his sofa. Kissinger explains, It's my bad eye, as the women rushed to clean up the mess. Mr. Sheehan says one widow recalled this. The next morning, Mr. Kissinger telephoned the White House to resign from the commission. The black hat of Mr. Sheehan's story is the commission's executive director, Philip Zelikow. Brilliant but abrasive and secretive, he is regarded by some commission staff members as a White House mole, compromised by his close ties to Condoleezza Rice, then President Bush's national security advisor. The book's portrait of Mr. Zelikow is harsh, but Mr. Sheehan seems to have reached out to Mr. Zelikow to get both sides of the story. The official ineptitude uncovered by the commission is shocking, dubbed Kinda Lies a Lot by the Jersey Girls. Ms. Rice comes across as almost clueless about the terrorist threat. Mr. Sheehan writes, quote, whatever her job title, Rice seemed uninterested in actually advising the president. Instead, she wanted to be his close confidant, specifically on foreign policy, and to simply translate his words into action, end quote. The CIA has some inkling that bin Laden is stirring to strike the U.S., but for many crucial months fails to tell the FBI that two terrorists are actually in the U.S. The popular image of the CIA as dashing and all-knowing is for the movies only. After much dickering with the White House, former New Jersey Governor Thomas Keene, the mild-mannered patrician who succeeded Mr. Kissinger as commission chairman, is allowed to read pre-9/11 copies of the president's daily brief, the CIA's digest of its most important secrets. Mr. Sheehan writes, quote, he found himself terrified by what he was reading, really terrified. There was almost nothing in them, end quote. Of the briefings, Mr. Keene said, quote, they were garbage, adding, there really was nothing there, nothing. Nothing. The CIA director, George Tenet, is depicted as evasive and exhausted, both from chasing Al-Qaeda and trying too hard to please everyone he worked with. The FBI bumbling verges on the tragicomic. Haunted by missed chances to stop the 9/11 hijackers, the FBI's acting director keeps a list of the Bureau's numerous mistakes. At least he, Thomas Pickard, was bothered by his agency's ineptitude. Attorney General John Ashcroft appears more interested in protecting gun owners. Not wanting to point fingers and name names, the 9/11 Commission shied away from holding anyone personally accountable. The Commission ended up blaming structural flaws for the government's failure to protect the nation and recommended appointing a National Intelligence Board to ride herd. The nation now has such a director, but with weaker authority than what the Commission proposed, and the position may turn out to be no more than another layer of bureaucracy. Ultimately, as Mr. Sheehan shows, the failure at the highest levels of the United States government was human. That is the real backstory of 9/11. Do you see, at least I see, what's happening here? Evan Thomas, who wrote this, is doing exactly what Sheila said to me in her email. Orwell said it's not the people believe what the press believes, not what they tell you to believe. I'm paraphrasing there. What Mr. Thomas is doing is saying, well, this was just, you know, a whole lot of human error. That's all, just human error. Human failure. That's all it was. It was just nobody could figure it out. Nobody could put the pieces together. Not the CIA, not the FBI, not the executive branch of government, not the State Department, not the FBI. Gee, gosh, golly, not NORAD. Gosh darn it. Everything just kind of, well, you know, like, didn't click into place. So, well, nobody's really to blame. Tragic day, terrible events, you know, just human failure. That's all it is. Move on. There's no malignancy here. There's no conspiracy here. There's no effort here to subvert everything about this country that we were taught to believe in. There's no effort here by the Bush crime family to take us into a war. No. Move on. Move on. Keep moving. Keep moving. Come on. Move along. Move along. Keep going. Don't tase me, bro.
story in your eyes. It's been shining down upon me now.
Welcome back. 6:30 past the hour. No, I take it back. 7 past the hour. And again, if you live in the Phoenix area and you want to have some fun, Saturday night, February 23rd, hang out with Scott Ritter and me. We're going to be at a gig sponsored by Nova M Radio and KPHX Phoenix. Tickets are on sale. There are tickets left, but there will not be as we get closer to this gig. So go to 1480kphx.com, 1480kphx.com, and snag a couple. Buy a couple, hold on to them, and then the night of the gig when people are standing outside wanting tickets, you can make a lot of money. That's one thing you could do, right? All right, Chucklenuts, on Friday, if you remember back on Friday, we had an hour glitch with the program, and we didn't get to what we wanted to play for you. This was just before Bush released his 2009 budget joke, which we'll get to a little bit later. But he was talking up his failing economy in Kansas City, Kansas, at the, of all places, the Hallmark Card Factory. He went to the Hallmark Card Factory, for God's sake. And while he was there, he spoke to Americans who actually still had jobs. But you have to wonder how long before Hallmark greeting cards are made in China, or if Monkey Man has his way in Peru or Colombia or wherever. But anyway, these workers at the Hallmark Card Factory in Kansas City, Kansas, were employed on Friday. And so they were forced to listen to Raisin Brain talk about the economy. You ready? 3, 2, hold on to your gag reflex. 1.
There's a sense of optimism. I was pleased to hear.
Where?
People are confident about the future, at least these business owners were, and they should be. Interest rates are low, inflation's low, productivity is high. But there are certainly some troubling signs. There's serious signs that that the economy is weakening, and we got to do something about it.
Yeah.
Today we got such a sign when, after 52 consecutive months of job creation, we lost 17,000 jobs.
Yeah.
The unemployment rate went down, but nevertheless, a serious matter is that for the first time in 52 months that we didn't create jobs.
Well, let's talk about those jobs, George. Well, why don't you talk about those jobs? Those are the replacement jobs, the jobs that were created by the wondrous corporatist American business community to take the place of the $25 and $35 and $40 an hour manufacturing jobs that went to, China, and are being replaced by $7, $8, and $9 and even $10 an hour greeter jobs or stock jobs at old places like Walmart or what have you. So, yeah, you've created a lot of jobs, George, and America is just pees its pants every time in gratitude, every time this subject comes up. We all stand here and just wet ourselves because we are just so grateful for what you've done. He said people are confident about the future, at least these business owners. Did you speak to any of the workers? You know, what your family calls the little people? And as far as the unemployment rate going down, George, it's very simple. I know logic is hard for you. I know math is hard for you. But if the economy dropped 17,000 jobs and yet the unemployment rate actually went down, you know what that means? Here, come here, let me tell you. Because people either gave up or ran out of benefits to file for. George. So now with these massive job losses, what does Chucklenuts have planned to fix the troubled economy? Another tax rebate. Little spending cash for the worker.
A concern is whether or not our consumers will lose confidence in our economy.
Our consumers?
You don't want that to happen in Hallmark. You want the consumers to still buy your product. on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And one way to address that issue is to have a temporary, robust tax rebate. And that's what we're working on in Congress. You hear this discussion of a stimulus package. Well, a key component of that package is to give you some of your money back so you can spend it. The sooner we can get money into our consumers' hands, the more likely it is that this economy will get back, recover from this period of uncertainty. And the fundamentals are strong.
Yeah.
We're just in a rough patch, witnessed by the employment figures today, and I'm confident we can get through this rough patch.
You know, why do right-wingers, these Republican pissants, these filthy dogs, why do they always talk about tax money as your money? They always say, the key component here, the key idea here, the real idea here, what makes us different from the Democrats here, we want to give you some of your money back. Chuckle nuts, when I know this is hard for you to believe, but when you used to be the chief operating officer of the Texas Rangers and people used to have to buy a ticket to come in and watch your baseball team, why do that? Why not just make the game free? Why didn't you give the ticket buyer some of their money back? You dumb bastard, because there is a price of admission. And there is a price of admission to live in a country of 300 million people because, George, we have roads and bridges and dams and publicly financed schools and government agencies that are supposed to keep track of things. And some of us still believe in a form of a welfare state that takes care of those among us. This comes from the Christian Bible, George, who are unable to care for themselves. Your Messiah, your great philosopher, said, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, care for the sick, you rotten son of a bitch. So when you talk about getting some of your money back, no, George, the price of admission at the Texas Rangers was anywhere from $25 to $150 a ticket to watch a bunch of men run around and play a child's game. The price of living in America, the price of living in any civilized country, you ignoramus, is taxes. Taxes are good, George. They really are. And the rest of you filthy Republicans, where would you want to live? Every time I hear Ron Paul talk about abolishing the IRS, I throw up a little bit in the back of my mouth. What the hell is wrong with you no-tax people? Are you out of your minds? You really want to strip out the funding for all this stuff you take for granted? Once you strip all the... Who's going to replace the stop signs? Who's never mind, Christ. This idea that somehow taxes are bad. No. They're not. It's the price of admission for living here. Jesus. Finally, Mensa Man here lets everyone know that the federal government really doesn't need any money. Where did you get that idea?
So the two key components of this package are, one, enhance consumerism by giving consumers money. It's not like a great gift. After all, it's your own money. I'm just getting it back to you.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard that, we need more money in Washington, therefore we're going to raise your taxes. Of course, it's disguised by saying we're only going to tax rich people, but that's not the way it works. Rich people tend to hire lawyers and accountants, and you get stuck with the bill.
Gee.
We don't need more money.
Oh, my God.
We need to prioritize your money. We need to be wise about how we spend your money.
And when does that start, dumbass? I'll tell you what, dumbass. You could save $2 billion a year right now by ending your illegal occupation of Iraq. $2 billion a week right now. We don't need more money. Okay, rich people tend to hire lawyers and accountants, and you get stuck with the bill. George, you're telling on yourself, dumbass. This guy is... Have I mentioned dumbass yet tonight?
There's fractions and my subtraction. and X don't equal Y, but my homework is bound to multiply. Math sucks.
Next year, I'm going to have to work on my math.
Yeah, well, it's too late, pal. 21 past the hour. Remember during the State of the Union, when was that, last week, Bush said that he's going to put the nation back on track to a balanced budget by 2012. Yeah, yeah, his wonderful fiscal policies, 4 years from now, we'll be back. He was handed not just a balanced budget, he was handed a budget that showed surpluses for the foreseeable future and paying down the national debt, and God, he just destroyed it immediately. In his State of the Union, he said that American families have to balance their budgets, and so should the government. Oh yeah, okay, George. But under Bush's new budget proposal for 2009, the deficit is going to jump from $163 billion this year to about $400 billion in 2008 and 2009. That's going to put the deficits right in the record, the area of the record of $412 billion in 2004. There was a surplus in 2000 when Bush took over. By 2004, we had $500 billion deficit. It's just amazing what Republicans can do with, how does he put it, your money, when you really cut them loose, right? The single largest contributor to this these substantial budget deficits in recent years, Bush's tax cuts for the wealthy. I don't care what anybody says. All these people that say that Reagan's tax cuts stimulated the economy are either fools or think you are. After Reagan's tax cuts, he instituted the largest tax increase in the history of the republic, and that's when the horrible economy that he oversaw started to turn around. Anyway, this new budget that he's come up with, it slashes over 100 domestic programs. Now, remember, he took office in 2001 facing a projected surplus of $5.6 trillion over a 10-year period. But his budget deficits that he's built up, according to Budget Committee Chairman Kent Conrad of North Dakota, will, quote, absolutely bedevil the next administration, end quote. Maybe McCain should be president, right? How about health care? Bush's new budget will include $170 billion in cuts to Medicare over the next 5 years. Hey, people over 65, how about that? And we'll also cut $1.2 billion from Medicaid next year and nearly $14 billion from Medicaid over 5 years. Yeah, he's a Christian. What did Jesus say? Turn the sons of bitches out into the street. If they're sick and hungry and naked, screw them. Right? Huh? Most of the Medicare savings in the budget would be achieved by, quote, reducing the annual update in federal payments to hospitals, nursing homes, hospices, ambulances, and home care agencies. Do you understand that? They're going to get the Medicare savings of $170 billion by cutting the federal payments to hospitals, nursing homes, hospices, ambulances, and home care agencies. This is very Jesus-like, isn't it? The largest savings come from cutting funding to hospitals, even as hospitals are closing across the country. 300 fewer public hospitals exist today than 15 years ago. William Dombey, who's the vice president of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice, said that under Bush's budget, 75 to 80% of home health agencies will be doomed. They will not be able to meet payroll. They will not be able to operate. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, quote, the president cuts are exactly the wrong medicine when the cost of health care and the number of uninsured continue to rise and families are feeling economically insecure, end quote. But she added, impeachment, of course, is off the table. Domestic cuts. To maintain his tax cuts for the wealthy, Bush's budget slashes 151 domestic programs. Poison control centers, 62% cut. Rural health programs, 87% cut. Community services block grant which is right now a $654 million program that provides housing, nutrition, education, and job services to low-income people, is completely eliminated. Did you hear me? Community Services Block Grant, completely eliminated. A new health program for 9/11 rescue workers slashed by 77%, even though this filthy administration has said that many workers were exposed to unprecedented levels of risk for lung disease and other illnesses. The budget also slices 22% from the low-income home energy assistance program. Jesus, God. They also want to eliminate spending for more than a dozen education programs, including Even Start, which promotes family literacy. They want to cut grants to states for classroom technology. They want to cut the supplemental education opportunity grants for needy undergraduates. They want to end a scholarship program named for the chairman of the Senate Appropriation Committee, Robert Byrd, Democrat of West Virginia. The CDC will lose $500 million, including $28 million from chronic disease prevention and health promotion. $301 million program that trains 4,700 pediatricians and pediatric specialists at children's teaching hospitals, eliminated. The safe and drug-free school programs loses $194 million, which is a cut of 64%. And states and cities will see cuts of $1.5 billion from the $3.7 billion in grants for security, law enforcement, firefighters, and emergency medical teams approved by Congress this year. Who wins in the budget? Oh, yeah, the Pentagon. The Pentagon's 2009 budget will be increased to over $500 billion, the highest level when adjusted for inflation since World War II.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
It's about 26 before the hour. The Bush budget cuts to me are just proposed budget cuts. Now, one would hope that with a democratically or a Democrat-controlled House, that this is dead before it even gets out of Bush's womb. A complete abortion of this mass of filth that he's presenting as his 2009 budget for his budget for 2009. But given the Democratic Party. I mean, you probably feel the way I do, or you wouldn't be listening to this program about that particular issue. I think we're in agreement that the Democrats will do nothing to stop anything that Bush wants to do. Nothing. And how do we know that? Well, we have a 7-year-long history to look at, don't we? So, to the extent that middle class or Americans or working class or working poor or retirees or sick people or children or hungry people are going to take it in the neck. Once again, the Democrats will determine how intense the pain is going to be. Now, the Democrats could respond, of course, by writing their own budget, which, of course, they will do if they haven't already. They will write a budget, and their budget will never, probably, ever even get out of committee because they are Democrats. The Republicans in the House will sit back and laugh their asses off. Bush will sit there and laugh his hindquarters off. The Democrats will eventually cave because the Democrats in the House and in the Senate are cowardly, incompetent, unable to fight, to resist this filthy Nazi machine. And a lot of them are in on the deal themselves. They are corporate Democrats. They are DLC Democrats. So when we sit here on this program and read this list of cuts that are proposed, a lot of people say, well, those are just that's just what Bush wants to do, Mike. It'll never happen. Yeah, it will. Sure it will. Just like the Democrats provided us with the new Attorney General, Mukasey, and the Democrats provided us with the two Supreme Court justices, Sammy the Fish Alito and John Roberts, the new Chief Justice. That those two people are there only as a result of Democrats' inaction and cowardice. The federal bench has been further corrupted because of Democrat incompetence and inaction and cowardice. So, you know, just like if Bush has lied about everything, why should we believe him about 9/11? If the Democrats have proven themselves over 7 years to have been totally knackered or neutered or rendered unable to do what the Constitution tells them to do, why should we believe that all of a sudden here at the very end of this filthy Bush regime's reign, they're now going to take Bush's budget, completely turn it around, and make sure the new one gets passed? Huh? Why should we believe that? Of course not. Oh, my God. Who's been holding on the longest here? David in Blaine, Washington, has been holding on forever. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Oh, Mike, you got my head spinning, as usual.
I know. And the pea soup is about to spew out, too, right?
Isn't it? You know, I'm listening, enjoying the show immensely, and I there's so many things I want to talk to you about, but only a couple of seconds. You know, when the Republicans were in the majority, we had that charade, the criminal charade in the 9/11 Commission hearings.
Mm-hmm.
So I was listening to you earlier, a couple hours earlier. And then, of course, Condoleezza Rice's ridiculous confirmation hearing. But Terror Storm, this DVD from InfoWars, you got to get. Have you seen it? Have you heard of it?
I have not.
Has crystal clear footage of Building 7 going down as the sun is setting on September 11th. 9 hours later.
If you would email me a link, I would really appreciate it.
It's unbelievable, including all the footage of the Aaron Brown of CNN and the BBC reporter reporting as if, mm-hmm. The World Trade Center building going down. And it's clearly in the background.
Right.
So they obviously didn't get the memo. But the reason why I called was, maybe you can chew on this. I didn't print the article because I read it Thursday night about American oil companies offered Iraqi parliament members $5 million per vote to pass this oil and gas law.
I haven't heard about that, no.
And I went to Google it to try to get to print it, and I could. There's something going on with Google because it's. I mean, we already know that the oil companies want to legitimize their presence in Iraq. There's this U.S.-Iraq pact that they're trying to arrange with the Maliki's government.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can have permanent bases there, you know, and all the crimes against the Iraqi people and their infrastructure go unaccounted for. Like these laws are going to protect them, you know what I mean? It's just this goes in line with those cables that were cut in the Mediterranean. You know, the information that's trying to be suppressed coming out of the Middle East, so that you know our fellow American brethren are not informed properly. If they don't know the websites, if they don't know the sources, they're not willing to listen because they have too much of an opinion. They don't want to hear anything because everybody's in just reaction mode because we're just overwhelmed by the information that needs to be.
Well, still, what you're offering is a better explanation than what's been floating around, that the cutting of these cables was a precursor to an act of war by either Israel or the United States against Iran. I hope it's what you are saying. I think it's very obvious that these cables were deliberately cut. This is not an anchor dragging or in this other back crap.
Exactly.
They were cables being cut. But and your reason for the cables being cut makes sense to eliminate accessibility to these sites that we need to go to.
You know, and that happened, what, maybe a day after I read that article, and I could not find it again. But my intuition tells me that this is exactly what's going on in Iraq, because, you know, there are a couple of Texas oil companies that have already created relationships with the
Kurds. Yeah, they've already cut deals, sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, and McCain is insane if he thinks that that in the general election he'll be elected president. I mean, none of these candidates get me excited. I mean, Obama's close.
Mm-hmm.
Kucinich and Edwards, I would hope that there's some kind of a strategy to because everybody needs to remember that the president just signs the checks and signs, you know, bills into law and makes friends with other countries.
Well, he has, you know, under the unitary system that these Straussian neocons have put in place now, the president exerts a hell of a lot more power than either of the other two branches of government, simply by his use of signing statements,
exactly,
by his use of the veto, by his use of pressure. You know, I can imagine phone calls from Karl Rove during the Bush years to key members of the Democratic Party in the House and the Senate that went something like, you know that bill the president wants passed? Get it passed, or three words, anthrax in an envelope. Oh, that's four words. Never mind.
Sounds
sorry.
Like the FISA bill that they're trying to get passed with the immunity deal for the telecom companies. Because Bush has been spying since Inauguration Day, not since 9/11. People got to get that through their thick skulls. We got to just be on those congressmen and women that have been enabling this rogue executive branch, and all the crimes and all the blood that's been spilled is on their hands, including those Supreme Court, inferior Supreme Court judges, too.
It's all true. David, thanks, man. I got to leave
you
it.
So much.
All right. Thanks, pal. I appreciate you checking in. Take care. Richard is calling from Detroit, listening on the internet. Richard, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. I'm
sure.
A little bit depressed here after the last 20 minutes going over the budget.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to go back and talk a little bit about 9/11 myself. And this, actually, we've had this conversation maybe a couple of years ago, and you kept me over on a break and everything. I was thinking about it. I probably have listened to your show for maybe 2,000 hours.
Uh-huh.
Over the last 3 or 4 years, I mean, easily.
Uh huh.
You know, and there's a reason for that, and it's that, you know, I have a lot of respect for you, and you know, and I agree with most everything you say, but we diverge on the issue of 9/11, and I wonder if we could just touch up on just a couple of points on that.
We may have time, but this is a bad time because we're coming up on a break here. When we come back, we're only going to have a couple of minutes. But go ahead.
Well, I mean, you would agree that the Bush administration is incompetent, would you not?
Absolutely.
Of course. And does that incompetence not augur against their being able to pull something like this off? I mean, just not.
No, because the incompetence is in governing. I think they are very competent in setting up situations that result in the kind of situation we're dealing with now. Just because they're incapable of managing government or doing those things required by the Constitution doesn't mean that they're incompetent where it comes to acts of pure evil. Hold on a second, Richard, and I'll come back. I got to take a break here. This is Nova M. I'm Mike Malloy.
Mike Malloy.
Riders on the storm.
No, Jim Morrison. No.
Into this house.
No. It's too spooky in here already. Thanks to the crew, Ian Huff, who engineered the program out of Phoenix and also answered your calls, Billy Foster, our technical our technical director, Ben Birch, our podcast manager, Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent, Bob, I'll get it out, Bob Alexander is our resident philosopher, Catherine Bay, the executive producer. We're talking with Richard, who is called in from Detroit. All right, Richard, I can give you a couple of minutes here, but then we're going to have to bail. Go ahead.
I appreciate it, Mike. Thanks very much. I know the time's valuable on the broadcast. When people say that, you know, why weren't fighters scrambled? Why didn't they get to these jets in time? I think there are two issues here. One is that our air defenses prior to 9/11 had always been designed to anticipate an attack coming from outside the country, Soviet bombers coming over.
Well, can I interject? Wasn't the country on alert that day because of war games that had been ordered, I believe, by Dick Cheney? So there is, I don't think, any excuse if we were already in an alert mode because of war games that were going on. How in the world could they have missed four hijacked airliners?
Well, they didn't realize it took about 40. Well, they didn't realize they'd been hijacked until the first one hit the World Trade Center.
Oh, wait. There are protocols in place, Richard. I don't mean to be argumentative here.
I'm glad you brought that up, okay. Because take the case of Payne Stewart. When they lost communication with his plane, now that plane had its transponder on, so they could track it with radar, as opposed to the 9/11 airplanes, which had the transponders off and it disappeared from the radar screens.
Okay, well, wait a second. The mere fact that four commercial jetliners all at once have their transponders off would, I think, have induced NORAD to say, Jesus Christ, we're under massive attack, launch everything.
Oh, I agree
okay,
with you.
Okay, but none of that happened.
Yeah, but they didn't get the message. The air traffic,
right,
you start with confusion at the air traffic control level. They're running into a situation that they'd never seen before. We hadn't had an hijacking in this country since the late 1970s.
Okay,
so they actually
all right. If they were in a situation, Richard, that they hadn't seen since the 1970s, what? Are you saying that the professionally trained military, professionally trained air traffic controllers all froze?
Essentially, there was a lot of that going
on. I'm sorry. I can't accept that.
Okay.
No, I can't. That's like accepting that a surgeon in the middle of a heart transplant, when he sees some blood, freezes and the patient dies. No, I can't go there, Richard. That is a leap of faith that I am not capable of making.
Just in the case of Payne Stewart, though, Mike, from the time that they lost contact with that airplane until they got a visual sighting on it from a scrambled jet, the time lag was an hour and a half. That's how long it took them to get a visual on that plane.
But wait a second. It was a non-commercial plane.
Mm-hmm.
It was somebody flying by himself. It was a private plane. The
right.
Circumstances are entirely different. That was not anywhere near four commercial jetliners with passengers who all of a sudden are behaving totally off the books. No, I'm sorry. The Payne Stewart thing is what it was. It has absolutely nothing.
But you still got an aircraft that you can't account for that might land, might crash into who knows where. It could crash into a major city, and
right.
It still took them an hour and a half to get a plane to where they could see what was going on.
I don't think that's the case. They had the flight path. They didn't know what was going on. The plane was not doing anything other than sticking to its flight path.
Oh, gosh, no.
It deviated from its flight path
because there was nobody controlling it.
But wasn't it a little Piper or a Cherokee? Or
it was a Learjet of some sort. It carried eight or ten passengers. Nonetheless. You're still talking about an aircraft that you can't account for. You don't know what's going on up there.
But what about all the cell calls into 9/11 from Flight 93? What about all that?
What do you mean?
Well, are you saying that all those calls were disregarded?
No, not at all.
Well, then why didn't something happen when those calls started coming?
Well, if you go back and you read the transcripts, again, these air traffic controllers, by the time they got around to calling the military at first, is this a drill? Are you kidding us? You know, that sort of thing.
Well, I look, Richard, you know, my bottom line on this is it's something that I can't really discuss, and I'll tell you why. The truth will never come out as long as I'm alive.
Oh, it will, too.
It always
comes out, Mike.
Well,
depending on papers, the Church Commission,
come out. What's the truth on the attack on Pearl Harbor? There's two stories on that. Number one, it was a sneak attack engineered by the Japanese. Number two, we had broken the Japanese codes and knew about it, and Roosevelt was desperate for a reason to get us into World War II because Congress wouldn't authorize it. Which is the true story?
A, the first version.
How do you know that?
Well, just on the reading that I've done
No. That's your opinion.
I'm
talking about objective truth. There is enough information out there now that's accessible by you that says Roosevelt and his Department of War knew that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor and did nothing.
No, I just don't believe an American president.
Okay. You don't believe that.
Right.
And I don't believe this. And whatever, like I said before, whatever gets you through the night, whatever, I mean, if you need to believe in a lone gunman on JFK, if you need to believe, don't you remember Operation Northwoods? Are you familiar with that?
Vaguely.
Okay, well, look it up.
Okay.
It's something that every American should be familiar with. A plan to launch exactly the same attack on the United States, but it was set up to happen in 1962. Exactly the same thing. Only Cuba was going to be the cause of the attacks. Not Al-Qaeda, not Iraq, not Afghanistan. Cuba.
Right.
And it was approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And Kennedy said no. So I'm sorry, I can't go where you are. What about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution?
We were totally lied to about that.
Oh, okay. And and how long did it take for that truth to come out?
I couldn't tell you exactly, but it did come out, didn't it?
40 years?
No, I think sooner than that.
35?
I'm sorry.
No, you're missing the point. The point is the lie was told.
Oh, yeah, I know that. No, I appreciate that. I mean, I know our government lies to us. We've known that since Vietnam.
How long did it take to discover the identity of Deep Throat, the man who exposed the crimes of the next administration?
Sure, 30-40 years. You're right. But what I'm saying is,
are you saying that this Bush crime family isn't capable of treachery? And if the truth will out, and I got to leave it there. Thanks a lot, Richard. If the truth will out, that's wonderful. But in saying that, you're saying that what's out right now is not the truth. I'll see you tomorrow night, True Seekers. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.